4-56, PGI Cozy, appellate from the Department of Navy et al. Mr. Cohen, for the appellate, Ms. Lyon, for the appellate.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it may please the court, Michael Cohen for the appellant, Dr. Icosi. I suggest that there are two main questions presented in this case. First, was the district court required to hear the non-discrimination claims of Dr. Icosi? That's a jurisdictional argument. And the second is, was the granting of summary judgment appropriate? And there's three sub-issues to that. First, that the district court failed to consider evidence altogether, that the district court looked at evidence not in favor of the defendant as opposed to the plaintiff, and that the district court failed to allow plaintiff to conduct any discovery whatsoever. The jurisdiction of this case starts with Dr. Icosi filing a mixed case appeal in May of 2003 with the MSPB. A one-day hearing was held in December of 2003, and under the erroneous belief that the parties had reached a settlement, the administrative judge dismissed the proceedings. Dr. Icosi went before the MSPB on an appeal. This process went on for over 15 months, at which time Dr. Icosi decided under 5 U.S.C. 7702 E1B to bring her entire mixed case before the district court. And under that,
I'll ask you about that. In the initial complaint she filed, where did she include any of her EEO claims?
With the MSPB. When you say initial complaint, her MSPB proceeding was a full mixed case complaint that was mixed case appeal that was filed, and she specifically included the termination as a discrimination retaliation claim.
What about her claims, though, that she had not been given due credit for certain work she had done, she had not been assigned to certain projects, all of those claims that were before the EEOC?
Those were previously filed with the EEOC. The EEOC...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your sentence.
There was an initial complaint and two amendments filed with the EEOC, none of which constituted a mixed case because they didn't meet the mixed case standard under the CSRA. At some point, namely her termination, Dr. Icosi then filed a mixed case complaint with the MSPB and included her Title VII claim at that time. The EEO office then said, we are transferring all of her EEO claims over to the MSPB. And I think if you look at the case law, it's clear the MSPB had jurisdiction over Dr. Icosi's termination claim as it relates to her discrimination, and under and all of her other claims ultimately boiled down to a harassment claim, and as long as one aspect of the harassment claim and hostile work environment claim is timely filed, it automatically brings all of them in. And there's no doubt before the district court that the court had jurisdiction to hear her termination claim, and therefore all of her pre-termination claims had to go in as part of a hostile work environment claim. What the district court did was say, with respect to jurisdiction, when a mixed case comes before me, I only have to deal with the discrimination claims. I don't have to consider the CSRA non-discrimination claims. That turns the statute completely on its head. It conflicts absolutely with the Butler decision in this court, which specifically said Congress intended that complainants are entitled to avoid exhausting administrative remedies before the MSPB. If the 120-day clock hits, they have the right to go into federal district court. It likewise completely conflicts with Ivano, where the district court said that
the district judge said they can come in, but that he has to wait on those for those claims. He has to wait on the MSPB for an initial decision.
Well, Butler's very clear on that. The district court has the option to stay and allow the MSPB to issue a final decision, but can only do so for a reasonable period of time. And let's assume a reasonable period of time doesn't go elapses, and there's no final decision from the MSPB.
If there's no administrative record, no decision from the MSPB, what's he supposed to review? The statute talks in terms of his reviewing their decision.
Not 7702. 7703 talks about it. And if you look at 7702, what happens if Dr. Icosi filed her original claim as a mixed case before the EEOC? It's clear what happens in that case. After 120 days, if the EEOC office does not issue a determination, Dr. Icosi goes straight to federal court with her entire mixed case. That means there is no MSP review, there is no MSP record, and there is no MSP final decision. And under 7702, it's black and white clear, and Butler specifically states the entire mixed case goes to federal court at that time. It would turn the statute on its head to say, well, if you go through the EEO route, you don't need an MSPB final decision, but if you go through the MSPB route, you need an MSP final decision, when the statute clearly sets forth that Congress's intent was to avoid exhausting the administrative remedies before the MSPB. That's what Butler says in black and white. And I think then if you get to Valentine Johnson in the Sixth Circuit, that decision comes out flat out and says a district court can independently review a non-discrimination CSRA claim without the benefit of a final decision, period, no questions asked.
So when the district court relied on the language in 7702 about in the manner and to the extent, and then distinguished Valentine Johnson on the grounds it was simply limited to its special facts, special circumstances, those are both erroneous decisions by the district court, in your view?
Yes, particularly because the special factual circumstances argument is flawed, because under the Supreme Court's decision in Christensen, special factual circumstances do not confer jurisdiction. So the district court, when evaluating Valentine Johnson, failed to realize that Valentine Johnson had to initially determine that a jurisdiction existed, special circumstances would not grant that court jurisdiction. And so Valentine Johnson is quite clear. Jurisdiction vested with the district court as soon as the 120 days expired and the complaint was filed in the district court. And yes, Dr. Icosi had wished the MSPB process was faster and could give her the speedy results she wanted. It was 15 months languishing with nothing, so she went to federal district court, and the MSP itself recognized that their process had broken down and issued a determination saying, yeah, Dr. Icosi, go to federal district court with your remedies.
Okay, I want to go back for a moment to something Judge Rogers asked earlier. You take issue with what the district court did with Valentine Johnson, but there's also the question of what does this language mean, to the same extent and in the same manner?
Yes. In the statute, I think that language is rather clear, because it cites various statutes. And if you look at up, let me pull out my copy of the statute, which and under 7702A1B, there's four statutes cited over which constitutes a mixed case. And then in that language, they cite to three statutes, but they don't cite to the fourth one. And it would be illogical to say that the citing to the three statutes means that you can't bring the fourth one as a mixed case. It was just showing you the type of hearing that is supposed to be afforded to the plaintiff in before the district court. And there's a distinction, and Butler is very clear on that distinction. The distinction is, once a final decision is issued by the MSPB, at that point, the district court reviews the MSPB record on the 7703 standard, and if there is no final decision, and time, and the district court feels it's finally time to go forward and hear it, it creates one record and issues a determination based on that record made before the district court without the benefit of.
You're saying this language doesn't constrain the jurisdiction of the court. In other words, that this language, to the same extent and in the same manner as provided, and then listing these specific statutory schemes. Now, the legislative history, the House Conference Report, says 7702E1 was enacted to, this is a quote, protect the existing rights of an employee to trial de novo under the Civil Rights Act if there is no administrative decision after a specified number of days. Now, that does seem to suggest that what the district court was doing here has a basis in the statute.
What's going on here, but if you look at Butler looks at the entire statute and makes it very clear. This is how all mixed cases are done. And then it gives a decision tree. If you have a mixed case, you can go EEOC, you can go here. If 120 days expires, you bring your entire mixed case to the district court. It plays counsel, and it placed Dr. Icosa on notice of how you're supposed to go forward with your claims. And that she followed the exact procedures laid out in Butler to the T, filed her claim, and then is told, no, you have to have proceedings going all over the place, one going for 15 months here, and keep on going, and then I suppose the district court can't begin to hear her Title VII claims until the MSPB rules. So is the district court supposed to sit and wait forever? The language in...
Let me ask you, neither side cites the Doyle case from the 11th Circuit. But it appears that all of the circuits that have addressed this question agree with your interpretation. No one cites the legislative history, as I recall, but you have the 11th Circuit, the 6th Circuit, the 9th Circuit, and then the 11th Circuit cites to the 1st and the 5th Circuits as well. I couldn't find any circuit that didn't agree with this position so far. And the only question I have in my mind is, what is it that's being raised in the arguments in this case that would distinguish those other circuit cases which have held that the district court does have jurisdiction after 120 days over the mixed case?
I don't think there's a single thing, and it's a good question to ask the appellees, and I would certainly like to reserve my time to respond to that.
I've given them heads up, since in their brief they don't cite these cases.
Yeah, I think it's very clear from, I can't see a thing that could possibly distinguish this case. And if anything, this case has some of the most egregious facts available, given the length of time, and the fact that the MSP itself said go to district court. I mean, what else was Dr. Icosa supposed to do? I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jane Lyons, on behalf of the appellee, Donald Winter, Secretary of the Navy. Seeing as the court has been addressing the MSPB issues, I'll start there because that issue dictates what issues the district court could reach. The question is, what happens when a mixed case languishes at, I don't like the word languish, I don't think 120 days is very long, but when a mixed case spends more than 120 days at the MSPB.
And didn't Butler answer that?
In a general sense, Butler does answer that, Your Honor, and Butler stands for the proposition, basically the statute as Judge Brown has been reading it, says what it means, what it says,
no,
which is...
No, Butler has that decision tree.
Butler has a decision tree. I think what happens is, after 120 days, the district court, the petitioner can come into the district court with a discrimination claim with the goal of advancing the rapid resolution of the discrimination claim, which would get de novo review in the district court. With regard to the MSPB claims, however, we enter a period, as the district court found here, where there is concurrent or perhaps parallel.
Let's not leave Butler.
Pardon me?
Let's not leave Butler.
Well, okay, I'm not leaving Butler. That's what Butler contemplates. It contemplates that possibility.
It says, is this decision tree, and there are at least two branches of that tree. And one of them is 120 days, and you get into district court, and the district court can continue the case for a reasonable time.
Right. The question
is, but it doesn't have to.
Exactly. The question is, what does the district court have to do?
And
the
it doesn't have to. It can proceed.
The district court can proceed with the
so
MSPB claims.
It has jurisdiction. That's my only point. Doesn't Butler say that?
It can exercise jurisdiction, but is not required to.
All right, but the district court said it lacked jurisdiction.
By the time it ruled in 2005, it did, by virtue of something that's not been discussed here yet this morning, which is Dr. Ekosi's own actions before the board, which ultimately led the board to grant her petition and dismiss her case.
You're going to say she abandoned her MSPB cases?
She asked the MSPB to dismiss the case.
But if a litigant is in two forums and one forum has jurisdiction, why, if she moves to dismiss in another forum, does the second or the original forum lose jurisdiction? That I don't understand.
It's really a matter of, and it's their argument, that sort of the MSPB or Dr. Ekosi, either one of them, could force the district court in some manner to exercise jurisdiction over the non-discrimination claims. The statute doesn't contemplate which will go first. Here, in this particular case, the MSPB deferred to the district court for a window of time until August 15th of 2005.
So the MSPB had authority to oust the district court of jurisdiction?
No. Either entity could exercise jurisdiction. And as we move forward in time, the MSPB gave the district court an opportunity, but also told Dr. Ekosi that if she didn't get resolution before the district court, before August 15th, 2005, she should come back to the MSPB. And she didn't do that.
She said, I'd prefer to stay in district court, because the district court, in my view, has jurisdiction.
She takes the risk then that the district court...
What risk is she taking? I mean, she may take the risk that the district court says it doesn't have jurisdiction and we agree with the district court, but...
Well, at this point, when the district court comes to ruling, it has final orders of the MSPB that it can review. There is a record before the MSPB. There are multiple final orders which can be reviewed. And the district court...
You think the statute is not contemplating a final review in the sense of having dealt with the merits?
The statute... can. In this particular case, the way the case resolved, yes.
Okay.
The statute contemplates reviewing the district court reviewing whatever the MSPB has done up to that point.
Now, the district court didn't use that rationale, did it?
It
relied on the language that Judge Brown and I have been focusing on.
It relied on that language.
It distinguished the Sixth Circuit Valentine case on the grounds of special factual circumstances.
Right.
That's all the district court said.
That's pretty much all the district court said, but it talks about it having concurrent jurisdiction, but it also recognizes the fact that in the MSPB's May 18th, 2005 final order, the MSPB had essentially reached its final decision in the case, and that is all there is to review. District court's not as clear on that as it might be.
Concurrent jurisdiction doesn't suggest, though, that jurisdiction's ousted.
No, I think the reference to the concurrent jurisdiction, the district court opinion, is toward the beginning, where it's talking about what Butler called the complicated tapestry of the Civil Service Reform Act in this particular set of remedies. And I don't think it meant to limit its, I don't think it describes its later resolution of the MSPB claims. So when the district court rules in 2005, and by the way, I think it's important at some point to recognize that we also have two different civil actions going here. The district court decision under review in this case is the one filed in the 2004 civil action. And that is the one that you know, arguably at least comes out of the MSPB. By the time that case is filed, the MSPB has already issued orders granting her, basically, her petition for review and remanding the case to the MSPB's administrative judge to decide whether her case would be reopened. The case is very much in flux.
Well, he was to decide whether or not her decision not to go forward with the settlement agreement was effective.
Right. Which the board had been treating as a petition for review, and that's the state of play when the 2004 civil action is filed.
You heard me ask about the EEO claims. What's your response there?
On the EEO claims, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I think, in other words,
when I was asking counsel about what he described as hostile environment claims,
right,
and his response basically was a Morgan response, that because the district court had jurisdiction over the termination, which was the ultimate outcome of the hostile environment, therefore it had jurisdiction of all the pre-termination claims.
I generally agree with that statement to some extent. I think it's important to recognize that there is no claim in the 2004 complaint that was filed in the district court that Dr. Okosie's termination violated Title VII, the termination itself. Now, before the board, after she filed her petition, Dr. Okosie's attorney at the time filed a statement of jurisdiction specifically excluding her termination, because they filed an action in the district court in 2003 to challenge that. So I think that the EEO claims relating to her termination were the subject of the 2003 civil action in the district court, which Dr. Okosie voluntarily dismissed in August of 2004, when she also filed the 2004 civil action. So it's not, I think, the attempt to rescue those claims as a hostile work environment flows from the fact that there is no claim for, even if you don't like the argument that she abandoned them before the MSPB, she certainly voluntarily withdrew the 2003 civil action. My time. Okay. The hostile work environment claims.
So just so I'm clear, under Morgan, then she would be required in the 2004 complaint at least to make some reference to the pre-termination complaints, and then the only question would be, were they timely?
Yes, and to answer that question, I think you have to look at the fact that the way to answer that question is all the hostile work environment actions obviously take place before she's terminated. The basis and the causes of action flow from events pre-termination. She had filed the EEO complaints. She had amended them twice. All of the issues had been accepted. And then in September of 2003, the Navy dismissed all those EEO complaints. So all the complaints that are the basis of the hostile work environment, and remember that by then, Dr. Okosie's also been terminated. Her EEO complaints are entirely dismissed by the agency, and the district court correctly found that from that point, she had 90 days to come into court and complain about it. She didn't amend the complaint that was still pending in the 2003 civil action in district court, and she waited until 2004, well after the 90 days, to come into the district court and complain about it in the district court. I would argue that all the hostile work environment claims are therefore untimely.
What about discovery?
That's exactly where I was thinking about going, Your Honor. With regard to the district court's decision to deny discovery in the district court's 2004 case, the Rule 56F affidavit submitted by Dr. Okosie's counsel is Joint Appendix 44 in the record. It's a relatively short document.
I thought it was rather lengthy, actually. It goes on and on and on in the paragraph talking about he wants to find out the motives.
Well,
I mean,
but
what more does a litigant have to say?
A good deal more, Your Honor.
Well,
the standard that has been articulated by this court most recently in Dunning versus Quander, it's a test of whether there's reason to think that it's got to be something beyond the veracity of the people who have given the testimony.
No, but the statement says, not only were these people not deposed in the administrative proceeding, but they have information relevant to the question of motive. And that's said as to various people several times. I mean, isn't that enough to alert the district court, particularly since the district court didn't have a full administrative record?
The standard is not one to put a district court on notice. The requirement is to point out facts that exist that are material and will create an issue of material fact.
So if a litigant says to the district court in one sentence, I need discovery because I wish to discover information from five witnesses in the Navy with regard to motive, and that information has not previously been provided through deposition or through an answer or any other means, that's not enough?
That might be enough, but that's very different from the case here, because actually we had an administrative hearing before the MSPB.
No, but the 56F statement said the administrative proceeding, there was no deposition of these people. Now, whether that's true or not, that's what it said. And all I'm getting at is I thought our cases were more concerned with the sort of conclusory request. I need discovery. See Rule 56F.
I don't disagree with you, but I don't think this Rule 56F affidavit went very far beyond that. When you look at the whole record, which I think the thickness of the joint appendix gives you some idea that the parties had access to a lot of records in this case, and the district court correctly found. The district court doesn't have to ignore the record in front of it, which includes testimony from people, sworn testimony, under oath.
What precisely was before the district court as to the administrative record?
Well, the parties, there was a hearing before the MSPB. Its hearing was transcribed and relevant witnesses testified.
That was that one-day hearing.
That was a one-day hearing. And then the EEO.
And the government never argued that all these people had been deposed.
We, in our opposition to the Rule 56, we did argue that the relevant people had given sworn testimony under oath, under questioning from Dr. Ricosi's then counsel. They had given the evidence. What the Rule 56F affidavit boils down to is new counsel's hope that he could have done a better job if he had done it in the first place. And that's just not enough because lawyers have clients and they are bound together until they change.
Well, it seems to me the question is not whether these witnesses were deposed, but whether the plaintiff had the opportunity to depose them or to have their testimony at the MSPB.
I agree, Your Honor. The opportunity for proceedings is also relevant.
Now, she makes two statements relevant to that, I think. One is that the administrative judge, quote, tightly constrained, the hearing to keep it to one day. And then I think there was yet another comment about that. But in any event, that somehow precluded her. What does the record shed on that subject?
The record does not shed terribly much light on that. The tightly constrained language that you've quoted is a characterization. There's, if that were true.
I understand that, but what does the record say about whether the, in your view, about how the AJ handled this proceeding? Look, if she submitted these witnesses
right,
and he said, forget it, you can't have them for some reason, then she's got a better claim here.
The record before the district court does not include the entire transcript of the proceedings before the MSPB, but either party could certainly have submitted it. And in support of a Rule 56 affidavit making that argument, it was incumbent on Dr. Ricosi to do so.
But the district court said these matters were fully developed. And yet you acknowledge the district court didn't have the full record. So how could the district court know that?
The district court had abundant evidence in the form of documents and other depositions and sworn testimony in the record before it.
In other words, these cases you've cited are cases where it's the trial judge knowledge of its own proceedings, which is a slightly different situation.
Yes, but Your Honor, there's no evidence in this record, and that's what this court has to review. There's no evidence in this record that the plaintiff's questioning was limited at all administratively.
And we know that because
because if there were, they would have told us about it.
Why? They told the district court it wasn't. Didn't the Navy have to come forward and say, that's incorrect, it's all fully developed? That's all I'm getting at here.
Right. I mean, it certainly is the Navy's position that the district court was correct, that the record, I mean, if you look at the record of exhibits, and only some of them have been put in the joint appendix, it's a voluminous record.
Well, we all know their records and their records. The question is, on the motive issue that the plaintiffs sought to explore, was that fully developed in the administrative proceeding, which, as you point out, was not fully before the district court? I mean, it's not as though it had a full record. That's all I'm trying to get at. I'm just trying to understand what is the rule that you're asking for. And I thought the rule was, citing the cases you cite, that you can't just make a conclusory request. And if you've had a prior opportunity, you don't get a second bite at the apple, as it were.
That's correct. The question for this court is whether the district court abused its discretion by denying discovery based on what it had before it at the time. The answer is there is no abuse of discretion because there was, I understand there's evidence and then there is evidence, but what all we really have here is new counsel's hope for a Perry Mason type moment where a witness who has given sworn testimony previously, who has been examined by counsel for Dr. Okosie, suddenly states something different.
I don't think it has to be a Perry Mason moment necessarily. I mean, that standard is very high. That's a total win.
Well, okay, that may be an exaggeration for clarity there, but what it boils down to is just new counsel hoping that when he gets an opportunity, if he had the opportunity to examine, that the testimony would have come in differently and been susceptible to different interpretations. All and right. That's not reasonable. It's not an abuse of discretion.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Lyons.
First, with respect to discovery, I'd like to point out that that the standard is de novo. There was no answer, no pretrial disclosures made in this case. What you see is a lot of documents. If you look through the joint appendix, a lot of documents. There's no testimony from any witnesses to go along with those documents. Dr. Okosie terminated her prior counsel because she felt the record wasn't sufficiently made for her, and she saw this one-day hearing process and felt it was completely insufficient and decided to go to the federal district court. First Chicago International, a case in this circuit, states clearly that the district court has to look at the pleadings. And if you look at the pleadings, it's clear Dr. Webb makes his not reference to Dr. Okosie not being a U.S. national. That statement happened after the MSPB hearing ended. So there was never an opportunity to question Dr. Webb on that. There was not an opportunity.
How did that come in? I'm sorry. How did that come in before the district court?
It is evidence of motive.
No, I understand. But he didn't testify.
He didn't
say that at the board because it hadn't happened yet. So how did it come in?
We put affidavit in. We put the statement he made in, but we were not able to question him. And the district court makes an error by reading that statement favorably for NRL and say, "Well, I'm not going to give you an inference on it without even giving us discovery on it." And the Seventh Circuit in that case was clear that ambiguities are an issue for the trial, not for the district court judge to make.
District court judge said that was in the course of an inquiry about for her future employment, correct?
Correct, but there's a long line of cases which goes on and says you can look at statements that happened after the fact to impute motive at the time the incident was happening.
The district court characterized that as trying to be helpful.
And I don't read it. I read the statement the opposite. And I think it's a jury question. And specifically, when there's no discovery on that issue.
How many witnesses did you seek to depose?
There were, at the time the affidavit was done, there was, I think, three or four, I think, is in the affidavit.
Three or four. Now, and does that include the three who were, how many, does it include anybody who was not, did not testify before the MSPB?
I believe one of them did not testify before the MSPB, but the important thing is...
Which one was that, sorry?
Excuse me?
Which one was that?
There's Webb, there's Booz, and then there's the human resources person.
I think the human resources person. I have to double check. I can't tell you specifically. But I think what's important with the affidavit is that the district court also goes on to say, look, you presented a lot of evidence concerning the office move and whether it was discriminatory, but you haven't presented enough evidence, so I'm going to rule against you. Well, how could he do that if we weren't given discovery on it? And Dr. Webb, and he makes a critical factual error saying that Dr. Webb was not associated with the office move, when in fact he was the person who personally moved Dr. Icosi's office. And so without giving us discovery on the office move alone, I think it would require reversal. I think that...
Did the office move the subject of the testimony at the board, or was it not?
Yes. And the district court says that, I believe, was the straw that broke the camel's back. The district court uses the office move as a justification for ruling against Dr. Icosi in summary judgment.
The office move entailed putting her into a shared office, right?
The office move was to move Dr. Icosi out of her office, and a process on... When she needed the office, they attempted to move her when there no office existed. They threatened her and were provoking her throughout that period of time, saying, move your stuff out. She's saying, there's heavy file cabinets. I can't physically move it. You're giving me a date to move out my office? What am I supposed to do? Go ahead and move my office. Move me wherever you want. There's office space up here that other male colleagues are using. There's empty offices. Can't I go to one of those? No. And she would be, and the harassment became so severe, and the district court failed to consider that Dr. Icosi, for the first time in her life, became significantly ill, seeking medical attention that her medical provider identified as being a result of the harassment she was facing at work. You had an exemplary employee with multiple years of outstanding performance, and as soon as she files an EEO complaint that's copied to her supervisor, everything falls apart in rapid succession.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Lyons, thank you. Case is submitted.